The reason I decided to get involved in direct action, because I realized, I suppose, in my 30s that this is a war. And actually, the system, the establishment, is doing everything it possibly can to shut people out of having a home of their own. I mean, I'm in Stroud at the moment, and here there are lots of little holes in the commons, right, where people have dug over in history to dig up stones to build their own cottages around here, and you can see these pits everywhere, even actually out in the woods or towards Cirencester and places like that. Just a hole in the ground where people have spent a few days digging into the ground just getting stones to build a cottage. Now, back in those days, we're talking really here about the sort of 1500s, 1600s, even into the 1700s, people would get those, they would buy a piece of land. So, that was relatively cheap. There was no such thing as planning permission. And once they saved up to buy that land, they would then build themselves a cottage on it. Now, that might be with the permission of a lord of the manor. It might be with someone else's permit. It might just be their own private property. But the fact was that people did things like that. Now, I have a few connections with New Zealand, and I can tell you over there, people do not buy, generally buy off-the-shelf properties from some big developer. They buy a little piece of land, some of it very cheap, in what they call the Wop Wops, which is basically these dirt roads running into the jungle, and they just build their own place. And that's just the norm. Whereas in the UK, what's happened is the war has left us in a situation where we cannot do that. It's just impossible. And if you try and get planning permission, you're blocked all the way. So that's where we are. We're like kind of rats in a maze, trying to do the basic thing, which is to get somewhere to live, which everybody needs, anyway, so that's why I got involved in direct action. I mean, I was in Oxford at the time, and got friendly with George Monbiot. This is back in 1995, 96. He was trying to get himself a Guardian column, and largely on the back of our land rights actions, he was, he got a lot of credibility there, and he got his column. And what we did was we identified sites from campaigners around the country, mostly in the south, because most of our people and supporters were in the south, and we just occupied them. We're basically sticking two fingers up at the land developer, whoever it was that owned the land. A lot of the time, of course, these pieces of property, slices of land, were just sitting there like money in the bank, because they, the speculators buy property, buy whatever, 14, 15 acres, whatever was on it, they demolish it, and then they just leave it for a decade or something as it accumulates value, what they call land banking. And when we did our, for example, I can run through some of the actions that we did. But for example, when we were in Wandsworth, we took over a big piece of land next to Wandsworth Bridge, which there was a lovely guy called Kirk who lived in one of the local tower blocks who'd been campaigning against this supermarket that they were going to build on there. And it was just one guy campaigning. It was almost like a David and Goliath struggle. But we saw this and we thought, this is great. Let's just go in. Get behind him, and so we brought three or four coach loads of people on a magical mystery tour, all ending up synchronized. The coaches synchronized to arrive at the gate just after the place had been opened up by another crew, and something like 300 people piled in, and we took over the place for, as it ended up, 6 months. But I can always remember being down there when a policeman came past and he walked in and he said, I drive past this place every day on my way to work and on my way home. And every time I go past it, I look at it and I think, what a criminal waste. And of course it is. And that's because capitalism is basically in a kind of manic terminal phase where, the people with the money have got so much power that they can just buy up various of our, infrastructure, that is to say, big pieces of land, and use it for their own personal speculation, land property speculation, like the casino. And so we as people are being increasingly shut out of, I don't think personally that anybody should have to pay a penny for the land that they live on, whether it's through rent or anything else. And this, as many people have said, the earth is a free gift to mankind. What are we doing paying somebody else just to be? So there's my sort of, in a nutshell, of why I do and did what I do. So, I think that the war requires the steely mentality to go and do direct action, to go and squat a piece of land, take it over, occupy it, and say, actually, you know, as we used to say, the land is ours. So, and get the message out to people that, you know, we can and we should do this sort of thing, because it's simply not acceptable for, I mean, you know what's happening now, as you just touched on yourself, people having rent increases at a time when fuel prices are going up. Basically, we're caught in a financial trap, in a financial cage, and people have just had enough of it. So, once we can get this wonderful land back, one of the figures I quote quite a lot is 60 million acres in Britain and 60 million people. So where's my acre? You know, this is basic stuff, but we have been shut out by the establishment. And the establishment mainly, I would say, is the city. You know, so we're not necessarily talking about the feudal system, because I think a lot of the feudal dukes, etc., some of them are actually quite decent people, and they, you know, allow people to walk on them, particularly around here where I'm in Gloucestershire today. They allow people to walk on their land with no problem at all. You know, it's a great access, for example, to the Bathurst estates around here. They just say, well, you know, just be careful, and after twilight we'd rather you didn't, but there's no restrictions from them. So the problem really is the merchant classes, not, I think, the feudal classes. At least that's my experience. And a lot of this goes back to the English Civil War, which was the, as everyone knows about enclosure, the privatisation of land. The English Civil War was a massive, massive acceleration to that process of enclosure, which was a privatisation of the land underneath our feet. And it was the first country in the world to go for mass urbanisation through the Industrial Revolution. Britain was, England was specifically, and the Civil War speeded that forward, because it enabled the powerful, wealthy merchant classes to get a grip on the land, to start elbowing out the feudal classes, and to say, well, actually, this is just a factory floor we've got here. So I think the Civil War is very important to understand the history of that, and actually the justice of Charles I's cause against Cromwell. A lot of people, for example, the Stop the War people I noticed the other day, are big fans of Oliver Cromwell. Well, hang on a minute. You know, this guy was a military dictator. And in fact, he was so bad that the whole country decided 10 years after the Civil War to bring the king back, because he'd been so awful as a military dictator running Britain. And also, of course, it's all the stuff he did in Ireland. So I think it's really important to understand the, you know, the Civil War was a key in the acceleration of all this. This led to the Industrial Revolution, as I said, and effectively led to the British Empire, because the people were kicked off the land in enclosures, and they were forced to work in factories producing, you know, all the equipment that Britain needed to expand and, you know, set sail around the world, to govern places, to take over places, with this massive pool of basically indentured labour, people that had no access to food except through, they couldn't grow their own anymore, except through working in one of these dark satanic mills. So that's it, I suppose, in a nutshell. As it comes to the Land is Ours campaign, we focused on a lot on the history. And I think it's important to do that, to remind people of the history, because this has been basically censored. It was certainly up until the Second World War, censored history, what happened in the Civil War with the diggers and the levellers, and there were other groups too, but mainly them. And they were absolutely right in fixing on land, particularly the diggers, who called themselves the true levelers, were focused on land as the main problem. You know, so they set up shop on St George's Hill in Surrey, which is now a private Beverly Hills gated estate in Surrey, and they basically did what we did when we were occupying. They just they put up some houses, they started to grow crops on the commons. Now, you know, it's almost a massive irony that it's now a private gated estate. But back in 1999, we got our act together to, first of all, to set up a public meeting on there. And then with all the people that had come, we invited them to come and stay on the hill. So we had already got a load of equipment in there, some what were well loads of marquees, basically a mobile kitchen. It was like a mobile village, really. And we set up shop with a lot of tents, people in tents, but there were also, you know, places that people could sleep, and we would make sure they were well fed. That lasted for about 2 weeks. And we got some terrific news coverage, actually, in, I don't know if you would today, but we certainly did back in 1999 on the London TV channels, ITV and BBC. So, you know, a lot of this is the political theatre. But it's also reminding people about history. And it was Christopher Hill that wrote The World Turned Upside Down after World War II that started to bring some of these groups, the diggers, etc., out to the public eye. And I remember when we were down in there in 99, which was the 350th anniversary of the diggers. So we, you know, we called it Diggers 350, and there's still an email list that I run called Diggers 350, which was started for that occupation. And if people let me know if you want to join up with that, it's the whole point really was to reiterate, really, because it started to die off, what Christopher Hill did after World War II, which was to stress the massive impact that the diggers and the Civil War had, or the, I suppose they were doing kind of what we did, really, which was to say, well, look, we're very much aware of this issue. We can't do much, but at least we can do something. We're not going to be, you know, sort of depressed or whatever about it, apathetic. We're going to go and do something. And one of the things I'd say to your viewers here, or the viewers here, people watching, is you must find others who are of a similar mind. You really must, because it's no, you can't fight these sorts of things on your own. We couldn't do it on our own. None of us could have done that on our own. We ended up with between 300 and 400 people coming to our on our march up to St. George's Hill from Weybridge, it was a terrific march. And then something like 200 of those people staying on site, or maybe 150 staying on site, actually up on the hill, until we were evicted in the High Court, which was a whole episode in itself. You know, a couple of people went down to represent us in the High Court, and came back with all the paperwork, which I've still got, actually. But anyway, the point is, as I'm sure you want to know, how do we get it back? I think, you know, you can use your imagination to think of political theatre, bad landowners. Go and find them, do something on their land, even if it's just a handful of people, you know, and make sure you inform the local news people. Because I think many journalists understand this. Myself, I'm a journalist. I was working for the BBC in the early 1990s, late 80s, as a reporter in London and other local radio stations. And you know, the impact of little things like this, you'll find, you know, you'll find that they're, I mean, for example, when we did our action last summer in August over in Brancaster, we got some very good coverage. You know, that was the first thing the Land Is Ours has done for something like 15 years, because we hadn't really done anything much since about 2003, 2004. And so that we've got stuff, we've got equipment, we can come and do things, you know, but, you know, the ideas are, find a bad landowner, do something on their land. And then what happens is people come out of the woodwork. You find all sorts of interesting characters will come along. Yeah, I think what you're doing is brilliant. Even if they just come along for a day. I always remember one of the things we did was the same year in 1999, we took over a derelict mental hospital in Norwich, which was a wonderful old mental hospital that every single window pane had been smashed. Quite obviously, to order, someone had been paid to do it, and it was just a brilliant place that was being sold off for housing developers. And we got over the space of a couple of weeks we were there, a whole load of people who had been to the mental hospital over the years coming to say hello. You know, oh, this place was brilliant for me. It helped me through a very difficult time. Blah blah. And so by doing things. By getting in the press, you know, you can make a difference like that. It's political theatre. And, you know, just having some sort of token of resistance is very important, I think. So that's why I mentioned this, is because you have to have that sort of mentality where you are prepared to go onto somebody else's land. I mean, I, for a long time, was squatting in Bristol. And it's funny, when you're actually squatting, you're not paying rent. You're in somebody's house, which is they're not using or they haven't used for a long time. We were in a housing association place mostly. I went to four or five different squats there. But you get this amazing feeling of liberation where, I can't be anywhere really. Is that what you're trying to tell me? When you're squatting, you feel like, well, actually, no, I can be everywhere. Everywhere is mine. And it's a tremendously liberating feeling. So, on to what do we do to get it back, right? Because this is the key thing. And actually, what I've been talking about is all about the right mentality to do that. I think, it's the at the heart and the core of all social injustice, the land rights, this idea of private ownership of land which is, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of acres. We're seeing things getting even worse now with industrial agriculture and big multinationals investing in land. So it used to be the big landowners, companies and individuals. And now it's things like hedge funds, and they are increasingly buying land. And you know what? They're backing, as I was seeing in Wales the other week, these hedge funds, investment funds, are backing companies which are buying land to offset carbon, right? So as this whole thing about zero carbon has come along, so the hedge funds are using it as an excuse to get control and ownership of more and more land, and they can pay for the land more than local farmers can pay. So that land is coming out of the ownership of local farmers and into the lap of the hedge funds. So this is an enormously pernicious thing, which I did circulate that report from Wales on the diggers list last week. So, we have got to be aware that all of this zero carbon stuff might just simply be a Trojan horse. At least it's being, I'm not saying it's not a good idea. I'm saying it's been immediately picked up by the big multinationals and our enemy, which is these enormous capitalist slush funds, to take land away from ordinary people. We've also got an enormous amount of land in the hands of people who do own their own homes. And what is happening is both Labour and Conservative are plotting together to make it difficult for people to pass homes on to their kids. Now, if that happens, well, it is happening, as we know. You've got to sell the house in order to pay for the elderly care fees, blah, blah. And Labour actually wanted to have a tax on homes, which means that if your parents wanted to hand on the home to you and they die, then what's happening is there is a tax on that house, which means that if you can't pay that tax, which may be 20, 30 grand, who knows, you have to sell the house. So this is really, really pernicious, and it's just a way of taking away the stuff that people have worked for years and years for their families and handing it over to the multinationals. And who is it that announced last year they want to be the biggest homeowner in Britain? HSBC has decided that they can have, by I think it's 2027, they want to be the biggest owner of houses in the country. So, we're up against a massive, massive like juggernaut, really. And I think the only way to do it is to, to actually get access to land is to buy it, really. I mean, pretty simple. And this is what I just talk about some examples, very successful examples of where people have done this. One is Tinker's Bubble down in Somerset, which I still visit quite regularly. And that is, I think it's 40 acres, cost about £50,000 at the time, and innocently bought. But quite quickly, people started putting up first benders and then a roundhouse and then canvas buildings. And now they fought over many years to get their planning permission. And I think this is again, why you need to have a bit of a war mentality is because when you start doing things like that, and it was just woodland originally with no permission to live there, the people who went there were a lot of them were from the Twyford Down Road protest. And they made this conscious decision that they wanted to stop campaigning against the things they didn't like and to start fighting for something they did want. And what they did want was eco-villages. And that's why that, well, I don't know if they would call it an eco-village. It certainly looks like that if you visit it, was set up. So they've got, you know, they've got gardens, they've got where they're growing food and all sorts. They've got mostly solar and wind power. I think it's only solar and wind, actually, and it's you know, it's a tremendous place. And you know, so a lot of their income comes from timber, because there's a lot of Douglas fir on there. So you know, you've got to think these things through. They've also got plenty of fresh spring water on there as well. The Tinker's Bubble actually was the well where the gypsies used to come. Well, mentioning gypsies, you can't not talk about Priti Patel's bill. There's an attempt right now to criminalise travellers, gypsies, which is just the most appalling thing. I mean, you know, these people have been living as itinerants for thousands, tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of years. Excuse me. So they're trying to make them criminals. So basically, what's happening is, you will have to pay to be alive. You know, if you want somewhere to live, you must pay money. And so one of the things I'm quite clear about is, this land is there for everybody for free. It's a free gift, and nobody should pay a penny for it. A lot of people talk about land tax, don't they? Land value tax. Well, this is just a way of making people make money out of their land. Who's to say that that's going to go to a good cause, that tax? It maybe goes to troops, you know, threatening Russia or NATO or something, you know, God knows. But you know, to me, the idea of taxing land is just completely potty. You know, anyway, there's a lot of people argue for that, the Henry George Foundation, etc. But we had a talk by the Henry George Foundation when we went to Wisley Airfield just before we went to, that was 95. And the guy started talking from the Henry George Foundation. Within 5 minutes, there was no one left listening to him. They'd all just walked off. Found him very boring. But anyway, so that's Tinker's Bubble, bought, I think, round about the same time in 95 for 50 grand, 40 acres, mostly woodland. And obviously, you've got to do this thing in collaboration with others. Another example, which is a little bit more sort of, well, I suppose comfortable, you know, comfortable living. A couple of examples are co-housing. So here in Stroud, we have something called Spring Hill Co-housing, which is a fantastic project. David Michael was spearheaded it, who's an architect, and he just was very determined. He knew, he got to know all the people that would make the decision pretty much before they made it. So he got to know them all socially, the various planning people, people in London, as well as the people in the Gloucestershire Council, Stroud District Council, all the others. And so he had sized them all up, you know, and then he got a really nice design for this piece of land. They bought it, and they didn't buy it on an option, as far as I know. They bought the land with the intention of building this, and it was quite cheap. It was, yeah, it was a big slope. So it was a question of, can we build on a slope? And the answer was, yes, we can. In fact, we can, you know, I think they're something like 3 stories high, their co-housing is. And they've got a lovely building there where everyone meets quite regularly. I'm not sure how often it is these days, but they used to have weekly and or twice, 3 times weekly meals together, which everyone was invited to. And obviously, well, one of the shocking things about that was that once it was built and people had bought their own flats there, well, they're really nice flats. They're fantastic. I mean, like 3 bedrooms, they're enormous rooms. David's quite, you know, he's a bit of an idealist as an architect. He wants places to be really nice. And they were finding that they'd already, literally, as they moved in, their home on the open market had doubled its value. So, you know, they're paying something like 150, 200,000 pounds for a flat, which is then suddenly worth 400,000 if they wanted to sell it. So, you know, this to me makes financial sense, you know. So that's Spring Hill. That's been going for something like, gosh, must be nearly 20 years now, maybe 15. But it's just a really successful co-housing project. Another one is up in Lancaster, Again, all these groups started with one or two or three really determined, dedicated people who then brought around them, gathered around them a whole group. Now, you have to be very, very careful. And I'll tell you why, because the Lancaster one, once they had actually bought the land for their project, because they managed to, you know, sort of get the finance together for it. And it was a, you know, pretty rough piece of land, you know, and it was, you know, there was a lot of the time they, you know, they're people are, you're making money because you're getting planning permission to build on somewhere that hadn't previously been built on. And that, at least the value you're making, they realized that after about a year of going down the road of actually designing the place, now that is to say, deciding who's going to live where, etc., and how many places can be built, what's the layout going to be, etc., what's the local authorities going to, I mean, he was a councillor, by the way, the guy that did it on Lancaster Council, which helps. So, you know, he doesn't have to chat to them to persuade them, he's already on there. And so, you know, so they found that there were people who joined their group who were being very troublesome. Now, they may have been idealistic in their own ways, but the initial two or three people made a very, very sensible decision to put a policy lock. They passed a policy lock motion through their group so that the initial plan and the initial objectives of their co-housing project at Lancaster could not be changed, right? So these people, after about 6 months of banging their head against a brick wall, left. And having spoken to the people at Lancaster, I got to know them quite well. They are absolutely convinced that if they hadn't done that, then the whole project would have been scuppered. And they're not sure whether these people arrived deliberately to scupper their project or whether they were just egotistical and, you know, as some people in co-housing groups can be, of course, you know, if you want to do things differently, you're bound maybe to be a little bit egotistical. Who knows? But they certainly believed that they had come there to really sink the project. And they didn't succeed because the people had not been so naive who set the thing up in the first place. And if anyone wants to visit Lancaster, it's just a gorgeous place, absolutely fantastic, right next to a lovely river stream. So again, nice communal facilities, a big hall where people, last time I stayed there was I think 3 nights a week. They have one at the weekend and 2 during the week, big communal meals. But of course the main thing is that the rents are affordable, because basically in co-housing you are the landlord. You are in control of, for example, service charges, right? So you're sitting on the group that decides on service charges. I mean, anyone that's, I don't know, I live in a housing association place myself, but we get basically massive increases in our service charges all the time from the landlord, which are totally unjustified. And we just simply have to suck it up, you know? So to be your own landlord, that's really what this is about, isn't it? And it's about making sure that someone is not using your basic need for you and your family to have somewhere to live, for your kids to grow up in safety and security, is not fleecing you. Because if they're fleecing you, then how can you be happy in that place? And also, if you're helping run your own community, your own place, you've got security of tenure, then you look after it. You know, if you're renting, what incentive is there for you to look after something for, you know, and a rotten landlord, as many of them are, not all of them, many of them are, and they're just there to get as much money out of you as possible. And if you want to do repairs, you have to just stop paying the rent, and maybe they'll think about coming and repairing the place, you know, but they're only interested in the money. They're not interested in anything else. It's like a religion. And that's, I'm afraid, where we're at with land. The religion of money is just shutting it off from millions and millions of people in Britain who need it and, you know, have got to have it. I'll just, just to finish, because it'd be nice to allow people to have, you know, a lot of questions and things, I'd just like to say a bit about our last action that we did last year, I mentioned briefly, which Linda was came along to, and it's just amazing. When you do a little thing like we did, the people that come and say hello are just fantastic. We met so many people from the local area who came and had a chat. We set up a yurt in a car park, which is a disputed piece of land on the commons at Brancaster in North Norfolk. And I would love for the Land Is Ours campaign again, to become a bit of a focus for this sort of activity around the country, and to have more people coming on these little excursions. I mean, we've had tiny, tiny events, but we've also had some quite big ones, like I was telling you about with, 300, 400 people at St George's Hill. It doesn't just have to be a historical focus, and this one wasn't. It was a focus of common rights holders, commoners, who were granted the land in the 1700s under the enclosure of that area. And this is all salt marsh, almost all salt marsh, but it's a lot of it is above sea level and perfectly walkable, although some of it we sunk into in the mud. We went out on excursion on the Sunday and came back rather with a red faces and very, very muddy trousers and legs and whatever. But what we achieved there, I think, was to just resurrect the whole issue of common rights holders. There are lots around the country. And I'll tell you, the big problem at the moment for commoners, that is to say, people who've got the rights to graze animals, whether it's horses, cattle, sheep, on commons around the country, are being attacked by guess who? By the rewilding people. I was just finding out just a few days, a couple of weeks ago, that up in Cumbria, a guy has been has been whose family had been grazing horses on the commons up in Cumbria for hundreds of years. He has just been made bankrupt in a court case launched by the Natural England people associated with the rewilding project. They don't want this livestock up there. What they want is they want it just to be left for wild animals. Now, you might think that's a good thing, but this has completely destroyed this bloke. We've also seen recently in Wales a big attempt to stop people grazing, or this is mostly tenant farmers who they don't own their own land, but they do have the right to graze cattle on the uplands in mid Wales. An enormous protest by the Welsh farmers saying, "Look, what is going on? These rewilders are kicking us off our traditional places where we used to earn a living." Again, this is wrong. This is just totally wrong. The idea that you can somehow make things better by taking away people's livelihoods when they have nowhere to go necessarily at all, these traditional ways of life, is totally wrong. The same thing, exact same thing has been happening in Dartmoor too. So, I'm pretty shocked. And I was also very, very annoyed to see where we were in doing this action, and I'll finish here, okay? When we were doing this action over in Norfolk last summer, that Natural England, along with the local wildlife trust, had been lobbying to stop public access to the commons all along the North Norfolk coast footpath. Now, this was driving the locals nuts. In fact, these quite a lot of them quite wealthy, saying, "Well, look, I moved here because this is a beautiful place to live, and I'm not going to be told you can't walk on the commons. Who the hell do you think you are?" In fact, he's saying, "I and my grandchildren and my grandchildren's grandchildren, if they want, will walk here any time they like." So there's a big attempt at the moment, I think, undercover of this rewilding project, to exclude people further from land and anything to do with stopping people walking on land, cutting off footpaths, cutting off access to commons, access to public land of all sorts, is totally out of order. So you, as a journalist, you will find me on Well, let's think. I did have a radio show in Bristol every week, a politics program, which was I was booted off the airwaves at the time of COVID because I was seen to be a danger because we were critiquing it. In fact, the very, very first program we did in February 2020, we were looking at the evidence that the COVID 19, I think it was called SARS-CoV-2, had been genetically engineered bioweapon. I mean, I'm not saying it was even now, but you know, we were raising this. This was a study which was circulated by the Zero Hedge site, and it certainly looked legitimate to me. So we were discussing that straight away. Anyway, within a couple of weeks, we were booted off the airwaves permanently. You know, there's a tremendous amount of censorship out there. I've been booted off better and bigger networks than Bristol Community FM, like for example, out of the BBC when I was working in Salisbury and looking into child sexual abuse in Salisbury. And I've since found out that Edward Heath was living there. I mean, I knew he was living there at the time, but I never made the connection that, you know, there was quite a potential that Ted Heath was involved in all this. But anyway, it would ex certainly explain why I was so quickly booted out of the BBC when we started looking into this. And anyway, so yeah, I think I'll finish it there. And the website is tlio.org.uk, tlio.org.uk, and that's the land rights site. But I also do a sort of current affairs journalism site and a 4-hour weekly podcast now every week, which goes out on various other small networks live. And that is on 5 o'clock till 9 o'clock every Friday evening. We're live. And the website for that is thisweek.org.uk. That's one word, thisweek.org.uk. So I'm afraid I'm sort of confined to the internet now, pretty much. Although, no, hang on, no, not quite. I do r fairly regular reports for Press TV, which is an Iranian state broadcaster, and who they did actually fly me over to Tehran a few years ago, which means I'm not allowed to go to Israel now. And actually, the Americans have shut me out too. So there you go. So that's me, and that's a message. It'd be lovely to have some questions.
Oh, thank you so much for that. And yeah, and for coming when you said you are a bit under the weather. And you still managed to do loads, that's really great. I was wondering if anybody has got some questions they'd like to ask.
Hi. Oh, hang on. Sorry, I take my get the video. There we go. Hi, Tony. Thank you. That was really interesting. There's loads in that I was like, oh my God. And yeah, lots of things I could ask, but just sort of starting from the last things you said, because I live near Dartmoor, I live within the Dartmoor National Park. What have you heard about what's happening on Dartmoor and rewilding and them getting uppity about people? I'd be interested.
Well, I mean, okay, so there are various reports online about it. I think there is some sort of Dartmoor. I'm trying to remember the details now. I was reading it. Okay, so what happened in Dartmoor was Natural England wrote to a whole load of people who were grazing, and they said to them, "We don't want you grazing in the winter anymore." And of course, this is an enormous, you know, blow to these farmers, and that this is on the moorland basically. And so they then got together and started making a fuss about this at a national level in Westminster, etc., and amongst their MPs. And then Natural England denied it. They said, "Oh no, we didn't write to them, you know. And what are you talking about?" Anyway, it turned out that Natural England were trying to pretend that, in fact, they then scanned one of these letters that they got through the post and put it up on the internet and said, "Look, this is Natural England's your headed paper. You've even signed it, you know." And so they said, "Oh, but it was a private letter. It says there it's not for publication, you know." But anyway, so they were using some pretty sneaky underhand tactics to really, I mean, imagine if you're a livestock farmer. I mean, you
Yeah,
know,
it's just not.
it's totally devastating to be told, no, you just cannot you cannot put any sheep up there. Now, I mean,
they don't surely have any jurisdiction. Who, I don't actually know who the natural England people are. Do they have any jurisdiction? Because Dartmoor National Park are quite, you know, they've got their own, you know, I honestly
don't know. But Natural England have obviously got some policies that they're trying to bring in. Mm. And, you know, anyway, they've fought back against this. So the thing is, the farmers are a pretty, pretty tough lobby. A lot of this has been reported in places like Farmers Weekly and hardly anywhere else. But if you look for that, you'll find it. I can't remember the name.
I'll investigate more.
The publication which represents farmers on Dartmoor. It's pretty, you know, it's like Dartmoor Week, no, I don't know what it is, but I can't.
I can ask some people.
But it was, you know, I was pretty shocked to see that them backtracking like this. You know, of course, if you think it's a policy you want to implement, you've got to have the courage to stand up and defend it. But no, they didn't want to do that. They just said, no, we didn't say that, but they did.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense, does it? The other thing, if I may just ask, say briefly, give time to other people. You were talking about the hedge funds and people, you know, with these conglomerates buying up, you know, for carbon offset. I mean, that's horrifying. And actually somebody, it makes sense now, because somebody who used to live down this way, South Devon, who now lives in Wales, I met her briefly in a shop, and she said, oh yeah, it's amazing, because she lives in some valley in Wales now. She said, oh, it's amazing how many people buying land in Wales have got offshore accounts. Now I'm thinking, oh, that's what all that's about. That is just shocking. I mean, it's absolutely crazy.
Well, there's no proper, you know, national scrutiny of this at all by any of the national papers. You know, I mean, as a journalist, I'm pretty disgusted to see most journalists, I think most people with half a brain cell, are the state of journalism today. But this should be a discussion. It should be a national debate about this massive transfer of land. Who is it, by the way, who's buying up loads of farmland around the world? Oh, Bill Gates. Wow. Our friend Bill Gates. You know, there is a definite move to take more and more land away from individuals, private individuals, and to put it into corporate hands. This means industrial agriculture. So, you know, industrialization, the factory floorization of it all. And, you know, we in Britain have got, I think, a very important role in all this, because we've got to, you know, because we did this thing of enclosure before anyone else, privatizing. If you go to France or Ireland, it's a completely different story. Ireland, by the way, turned the whole thing round in the 1880s because they had a horrific rack renting landlord system in Ireland, where the factors, that's the, you know, the estate managers for the absentee landowners in Ireland, the British, the English mainly, they were squeezing rent out of these poor farmers. And due to the balance of power at Westminster, the Irish had MPs in those days, and they managed to do a bargain, a deal, where they got government loans for the Irish, poor Irish peasants, to buy their own properties they were peasants on, and to build a house on it. And after they got that loan, the repayments on the loan were far less than the old rents had been, you know. Right. So that's why you've got this amazing situation. If you ever go to Ireland, you find there's all these lovely sort of farmer types who've got the time to spend the day with you, sort of lean against a hedge or a gate and have a good old chat with you, because they're not rushed off their feet, desperate to make a living, because they own their own property now after the 1880s. And the same is true in France. Lots and lots of small owner occupiers. We in England and Britain generally have been absolutely maniacal on taking this land off people.
Yeah, it's shocking. Yeah, it's. Anyway, thank you. Thank you very much.
Hey, Linda, did you got a question?
Yeah, I do. On the community right to build that the UK government told us we had on exemption and exception sites, if you had proven need for eco-village type communities, what happened to the exemption and the exception sites? Have they also gone to the highest bidders now, and is the government's just in denial that there is this need and this demand to get out of anti-social social housing and build our own communities for safe places for people to live in?
I don't think they ever intended to do that, Linda. I mean, what they do, I think, is they come along with some sort of great sounding scheme that they hope that virtually nobody will get their act together to do. Now, in order to do these things, like I said, you've really got to get together a whole team of people who are experts in the various areas to do with construction, to do with planning, you know, and to do with public relations, to do with, you know, lobbying, wining and dining the people that you need to convince in order to get one of these schemes off the ground, you know. And that's what they did at Spring Hill and in Lancaster, you know. So in order to do something like that, you really do have to be, you know, have to get a pretty good team behind you. But certainly they're never going to just give you the land, no chance.
No, they put 24 million out, didn't they, in 2013. I went to the Getting It Built event, which was co-housing, etc., Ely Cathedral in 2013. But the local authority had 2.4 million of that, and that's gone to precious little schemes. So it hasn't gone where it was supposed to go, anyway.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've seen a lot. We had a Bristol co-housing group as well, but they were very peculiar. I don't know what had happened to them, but their meetings were incredibly tedious, and they seemed to have completely lacked direction. And they were fighting over minutiae, you know. So maybe they had been infiltrated. I don't know. Maybe it's just some of these groups. I mean, I think, you know, you've got to have a good understanding of group dynamics as well in order to see whether, you know, a group is going to function or not and it's going to be able to do it. But you do have to, I think, to have that basic vision. This is what we want, and we're prepared to build the expertise. You know, it's force multiplication. That's what they call it. You know, if it's just one or two people, it's not going to work. You need to have a whole bunch who are all behind it. And they, you know, so then what happens is if one person is knocked back, then someone else turns up and lobbies the same person. And if they're knocked back, someone else turns up until they find somebody that they'll listen to. You know, there's all sorts of reasons why the people that you're lobbying, the planning people, etc. Obviously, you know, this is the planning is a hell of a, you know, obstacle course, but it's not impossible. There are people out there who do this for a living, and
I do. I mean, the planners weren't the problem. The problem was the land. And even if you've got the people, and even if you've got the proven need, and you tick all the boxes 100 times over, if there's no land, you can't actually build it in the air.
There is land. There's plenty of land, and there's loads of land out there. A lot of it is just is either unused, derelict. The thing is, it's mostly cheap if it's not being built on. If it's brownfield, it'd be more expensive. But the trick is to find a nice piece. At the moment, the planning rules, I've no idea what the situation is in 2022, really, because things have changed so much. There's people getting planning permission to build on greenfield sites all over the country now, and including around London, you know, the old Greenbelt sites. So the land is there, Linda. You know, you can see it as well as I can. It's just, it's expensive. If the planning is going to be easy, it's expensive land. If the planning is going to be hard, it's cheap. But there's definitely land out there. And, you know, you can't expect what you have to do in order to tick the boxes with these government schemes is to get your group together and come up with buy a piece of land and just tell them, right, this is it. We're doing it here.
It's the buying that's the problem. So those that form the communities want to live in communities. A lot have proven needs, self-employed, no regular income. You can't afford regular rents, regular mortgages or regular anything else. So you form a community and you tick all the boxes and you've got the planners twinkle in the eye. They love the idea. But what you can't do, the exemption and the exception sites haven't been set aside. And if you can't get a bank account, you can't get any grant funds. You can't get the land with money, because that money was supposed to have been set aside and was set aside by the government based on the back of all the exemplars of sustainable design that have already set important planning precedent.
Yeah, but you're talking about money, really.
You're
talking about money, really. And if you've got a cohesive group of 30 or 50 people, you will have money. But some of those people will have the money. And even if they have to, you know, sort of lend it or whatever, they, we can juggle things and, you know, you will buy the land. So I think, you know, just saying that money is the reason why you can't buy the land, you just need to, you know, have a bigger group. And that's what they did in, you know, in Stroud and in Lancaster.
Yeah.
Well, maybe if we can have these more regularly, maybe like more bigger groups will come with more variety. Who knows?
Can I just jump in, Tony? You mentioned Bristol, because I used to live up in Bristol, and the Yard, which was a self-build project in Bristol. They did really well, and they had meetings for years. I did go to some of their meetings.
You're right. That's a very successful. It was very successful.
Yeah. And they've got another. They've got another, because I've been rummaging around looking at stuff for all this year so far, and they've got another. And I think the Yard lot are helping them. Bridge Farm self build. It's a new project down that way. I think it's sort of nearby the Yard.
I mean, are self build. You're right, but I mean, of course, that's another thing. But I mean, I just think co-housing is really the, you know, more of a sound objective, so you can bring a lot more people in on a project than you can on a self-build, because most people don't actually want to build their own house themselves. Yeah. I mean, obviously a lot of self-build is bringing contractors in to do this and that, but you know, if you've got a professional builders building you a co-housing project, then you put your money in. And I mean, for example, with Spring Hill, you know, you put your 150 grand.
I visited there
You put years ago grand in, 2 years later you move into your place and you're sitting there on a nest egg of something like $500,000, you know.
There's one for sale now, it's about 700,000. You need a lot of money to live at Spring Hill.
Well, yeah, but you didn't need that sort of money to build it. This is what you need to have the confidence, you know, to do that. Now, I mean, you know, this is what I said at the start about direct action, is I think you've just got to have a steely approach to it, right? I'm doing this, you know, and whatever comes in my way, we're going to sweep it aside with a smile, you know, that sort of approach. And also, you've got to be good at getting on with people and understanding their differences and their needs, you know, so to form these newer groups, something. But you're right. Yeah, the self-build group in Bristol was really successful. I think it was an old scaffolding factory or firm that sold.
Hence the name, the Yard. I mean, it was just an old yard.
Yeah, all sorts of different places, a bit higgledy piggledy, but it's not everyone's thing, self build. And the co-housing group, I mean, gosh, I don't know what I think, that I eventually got an email off them, I think, about 10 years ago saying, oh, we have decided to disband. And I thought, well, thank God I missed out 10 years of pointless meetings then, you know.
happens, doesn't it? I think you were saying, Catherine, well, you know, a lot of these places you can go years and years of meetings and then it all falls apart and everybody goes their separate ways, you know. It can be a
still learning. We did have actually before we kind of went our ways, and some people have got land now, it was buying the land was the main hurdle, really. There was us versus developers, you know, and the developers won in getting the land. But it's all learning, and there's, you know, there's learning, and some of us have managed to find little bits now, even if it's not together, it's like little bits which are still living on the land.
Well, let me say something else as well, because I think particularly for owner occupiers, farmers that are selling land for whatever reason, they are quite picky about who they sell it to, you know, so they will take a drop in price. You know, they're not just looking for, not necessarily just look, especially if they're elderly, you know, they're not just looking for the dosh. So don't assume that you know, that's the case. So if your face fits, a farmer may well sell you land far below its commercial value. That's what they found at the Tinker's Bubble, is the land was probably worth at least, you know, two or three times as much. But the guy liked them, you know, he was just a bit of an old fashioned bloke. And he said, oh, yeah, go for it. Go on, yeah, 50 grand, I'll sell you. So, if you know, it pays, I think, if you decide roughly where you want to live, go and get to know landowners around there, big landowners. Say, oh, look, yeah, we're looking for somewhere with a spring and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, a lot of these owner occupier landowners, whoever they are, farmers, big farmers, small farmers, even feudal lords or whatever, ladies, they are open to little things like this. And or they may be anyway. So it's well worth getting to know them, and not to just assume you've got to go and look in the Exchange and Mart or whatever they have nowadays to buy a piece of land. Go and talk to people face to face.
I've got to say, Wrexham Council were at the time were very supportive of us as well. They kind of came to us as, or we came to them as, they're in need of affordable housing, and then here we are wanting to provide affordable housing. So it's possible.
Yes. Yeah, so, who was that popping up saying a community land trust should have the first option to buy it back?
Oh, yeah, Martin, is it? Because you were saying about the Bristol Community Land Trust.
Yeah, hello. Yeah, that was me saying that. Well, it wasn't really, I don't think it's related to Bristol Community Land Trust, but I guess thoughts I've had in the past is that if you have a community land trust or cooperative which has a development, that they should get the option to get the property back, first of all. So and buying it back at some similar price to what it's sold for, or a price related to local wages. And then if you have a network of these CLTs and cooperatives, people who live in them can move around them at that price and not have to chase the commercial market, essentially. That'd be the ideal situation.
So the housing co-ops I was talking about, the co-housing places, are set up on a totally different financial model to that. So the idea is more people will buy into a project and put their money behind it if they know that they will benefit from any increase in value. You know, so it's just common sense. If you're saying that, you know, you have a financial stake in this, you personally have that, then people are going to be much more into it, and they're prepared to put more money into it. If they're told, well, this is going to be somewhere to live, but you know, you're not going to be able to, it won't actually be, you know, your investment in it, whatever it is, won't grow, then less people are likely to invest in it. So, I mean, it's just, you know, it's different strokes for different folks. I mean, yeah, Community Land Trust, I was actually on the Community Land Trust board in Bristol when it first started, and I got booted off by this guy called Keith Cowling. On a completely, he was basically a bully who was, I don't want to get too much into this, but he was, you know, he was treating some of the board members, I thought, in the board meetings as chair in a really bad fashion. I had to say things like, well, look, hang on a minute. It's not her, decision. She's been to her board. She's asked them and they've said no. So, you know, stop having a go at her because it's not her fault. Anyway, I found myself booted off the board of it. So that, you know, the community land trusts sound great, but, you know, there's some pretty, you know, there's, I personally didn't get on with the way that Bristol Community Land Trust was run. And it's probably just as well because Bristol City Council were helping fund it at the time. And they don't like me as a local journalist that's quite critical of the council. So it kind of was, you know, it was almost inevitable that something would happen. I mean, it's been very successful since, you know, what we set up in the Bristol Community Land Trust has been brilliant. You know, it's all sorts of projects now come to fruition and got lots of happy people living in there for like a decade or so now.
Yeah, I have to say, Martin, that's sort of my, you know, I was going towards the Community Land Trust. I really, you know, I think it's very amenable to councils and local authorities. And what you described would be my dream. That is, you know, a set of cooperatives, community land trusts around the country with that collection. And at the same time, you know, keeping the price, you know, I know it's maybe less wanting to invest because you're not going to get double, but to have a similar price to keep it perpetually affordable would be lovely. So
it's going back to seeing housing as somewhere to live rather than an investment.
Indeed. Well, the Community Land Trust acted as a blanket to ensure that the price values didn't go up. And this was what that whole thing was, because we first had council housing, which Gold sold off, and then we've got the Housing Association housing, which is just like any corporate body. And this was to ensure that those of us who wanted to could build our own houses under our community right to build and our community right to bid, or even our individual right to do so, if we had proven need, i.e. that what we're living in is causing poverty, fuel poverty, child poverty, etc. It doesn't, the system is failing us, and they keep cutting back on all of the benefits, etc. There's more proven need by more people now than there ever was before for this. And that ensured that you didn't sell off to make the profit. I mean, the co-housing groups have got a lovely way of doing things, apart from it's a standard profit on house. When people used to build villages like Great Riborough, 29 Hythe Station Road was originally, so the architectural historian said, the community hub. So they had a hatch out onto the main road where hot food was served to everybody building the houses together as a community. And that was hundreds of years ago. And it's basically the same now, isn't it? We could be doing it in theory.
I think Wales is getting closer, but yeah, I'm sort of, you know, there's talk of it in the local council. There's talk of it, but I think there's still some way to go. They probably need assistance, I think, with that. Oh, they say in all councils are signed up to UN Agenda 21-2030 and Common Purpose. Their real values are not aligned with ours. We'll have to look into that.
Well, maybe, yeah. And look, I think the thing is, there is a reality of the property market out there, and people are quite recognised that they're putting a lot of investment into their homes, whether it's to buy it or build it or whatever, and that they want that house to be theirs. I mean, same countries like Germany, this isn't the norm. Most people rent their properties, but it's perfectly legitimate to say that I want these bricks and mortar to be my personal property that I can then hand on to my kids, for example. We had many years ago, we had a system of land tenure. I mean, we haven't even touched on this, which is the idea of leasehold and freeholds, yeah? But it was the copyhold. So the copyhold was, in fact, looking at the open field system, this was the system before enclosure. What you see there is a completely different way of owning land and managing land. It was understood in that system that everybody needed land. And so even those that didn't have anything, there was land set aside for them, which was called the waste of the commons, you know, so there'd be kind of, you know, where they could go and stick their caravan, or they could build a little shack or something. And even the word dole, which many of us, you know, I don't know if it's used much nowadays, but certainly in my 20s and 30s when I was on the dole, I didn't realise this word actually was came from a piece of land, which was, I think it was, I had to look right back in the Bodleian Library in Oxford when I was living in Oxford, to a dictionary from something like 15 or 1600 or something ridiculous, to see that the word dole originally meant a part or portion, most commonly of a meadow, where several persons have shares, right? So this idea that, you know, you're going to take a bit of money every week, well, no. You're given land instead, and it's going to be much more sustainable to do that than to force you into the financial system. The open field system is really worth having a good look at. People don't know it. It's just as a really good model for sharing land. And it's basically, you know, much common land is worked on that system. So you had
call that system, Tony? Can you repeat that?
The open field system. And each village, and this to be quite frank, this is the way that it naturally emerged from the days of yore, right? So we're talking about, you know, almost like the first people that stopped hunting and gathering and settled decided that the land was best managed. And so that open field system is involved a lord of the manor, who was the sort of boss of the village. He would be a minor feudal lord of some sort, and he would above him have a couple of levels above him, and would have a duke who would be probably ruler of the county, who took their authority from the king. So that's the way it used to work. And you know, you could be ordered around a little bit by the lord, right? Because you had to go and do so much a year, so many days work for him. You had to turn up and go and work for the lord. But you had security of tenure, which is so crucially important. You had this thing called a copyhold, and that copyhold meant your home was you could you could never be evicted, and you could hand it down to your kids. So that copy, that's why it's copied to, you know, to the descendants. And that copy hold went out, I think, in the early 1900s, late 1800s. But it's the traditional way of doing things. The land was generally managed on the open fields were generally managed on a crop rotation system. So you'd have something like three massive fields. So much, much less in the way of hedges in the countryside than we have today. And they would be rotated. So you'd have two of those fields would be growing, and one of them would be fallow. That's in order to preserve the soil so that it doesn't, you know, you're not overdoing it. And everybody in the village would have, basically it was like a massive allotment. So wherever you see these ridge and furrow, you know, if you go along in the car, you look out the window, you can see these kind of lumps in the fields. Those are the old ridges and furrows of the open fields. So it was on the ridges, not the furrows, because that was for drainage, that all the crops were grown before enclosure. And so it's interesting, isn't it, how even in our fields today, you can see the remnants of the pre-18th century, you know, pre-1700s, which was the big century of enclosure system. You can see evidence of it all around you, the ridge and furrow. Most of those are just used for grazing now. They were used for growing things like carrots, potatoes, and whatever. And because it's grazing, the actual lie of the field. I mean, what was happening, you know, just to explain the enclosure, was that those areas that had been being cultivated by local people were then turned over to sheep almost entirely, because the sheep and the mostly the wool was a major, major, economic force back in those days. And not so much the meat, but the wool that these sheep produced every year. And that it was much, much cheaper, wasn't it? Imagine if you can buy up the rights that all those people had to those open fields and just cover them with sheep. Well, suddenly you make loads of money, don't you? And this is what happened, apparently, is a lot of these enclosures were forced by big, powerful local merchants, who were often big farmers too, gambling in London and losing money and having to basically pay it back by making more money out of their farms. And so they could get an act of enclosure through Parliament to kick all those people out of their cottages that they'd had for, you know, countless generations, and leave them sort of to, I think the compensation they got was like a barrel of beer or something like that, you know, for in exchange. So that enclosure system, the pre-enclosure system, there is one place in Britain you can see it in action still, because it's still managed by, it's a village of Laxton in Nottinghamshire, which is near Newark. And if you're up there in the summer, the locals are very friendly. The publican will tell you all about the open field system, because it's, I think it's part of the Crown Estate. They've preserved that one village. I think it's the only one left in the country as a village which still runs the open field system. So, you know, someone somewhere has thought, well, this is worth preserving, even if it is just one little place. The other thing to say about all this is, and I hadn't even mentioned the Scottish crofters, because they have also a very, very good model of land management. There was a massive battle back in 1888, I think. It's called the Battle of the Braes in Skye, where a whole load of people were going to be evicted through enclosure. I mean, what happened is, you know, the enclosures happened in England, but then we had the Highland Clearances in the 1800s, much worse in many ways, because people were so far, that the cottages were so far from civilization that people could be burnt out of their homes. You know, some were burnt alive in their homes because they were elderly, they couldn't get out, you know, whatever. So when these enclosure people came along, they just burnt the cottage and they didn't know there was someone upstairs or didn't care. There's a terrific book, I think it's by John Preble, called The Highland Clearances. But this all came to a head in 1888, and a whole bunch of police and bailiffs got the ferry over to Skye, and they were marching early in the morning over to evict these people. Anyway, on the way, out from behind rocks jumped loads of people. The women of Skye had got together because the men apparently were a bit flaky, and they said, "Oh, we've got to do what the Laird says," you know. The women decided no, and they got hold of these rocks and they lobbed them at the police and they lobbed them at the bailiffs and drove them off. And it just so happened that there was some guy there, I don't know if he'd been tipped off or what, who was maybe he was even on holiday, I've no idea, but he was wrote an article for the next day's Times newspaper. And I suppose they get it in those days. I don't know, would it have been Telegraph or Train or whatever down to London? Anyway, he wrote an article about all this, and it was called, I can't remember the title of the article, but anyway, it had a massive effect. Everyone who was reading the Times said, "This is absolutely appalling. What the hell's going on here? You know, this is all happening out of sight, out of mind," a bit like the old triangular slave trade, isn't it? You know, so if it's not happening on your doorstep, you don't know it's going on. If the media don't tell you. Anyway, so this was in the Times, and then there was a royal commission. They set up a royal commission into the grievances of the crofters. All the enclosures and the clearances stopped at the time, and they set up in law, they enshrined in law under the Crofting Act the previous system. So the previous system had been a very similar to what I was saying about the open field system, which is that you pass your croft down through the family. One thing now, if you visit a proper crofting area, you'll find there's a whole load of houses at the bottom of the valley. Those people who live there cannot sell their house, you know. So in a way, it goes with what my friend was saying just now about housing co-ops, community land trust. Yeah, so you can't sell it. Yeah, anyway, so you can't sell your croft. All you can do is pass it down in the family, and you know what that means? That means you cannot, it cannot be used as collateral against a loan, a bank loan, which is how most people lose their homes, or many people over the years have lost their property, is through having a bank loan, and then they can't then pay back, and then they, you know, the security, the bank takes the house. So and they also have, so they have a quite a big slice of land, so usually about sort of 5, 10, 15 acres of land attached to the house, which is their own personal, to do what they want with. And they also have grazing rights on the hills. So that all in all means you've got basically a job for life. You know, you've got an income for life by whatever. So even if you're not using your own piece of land, you can rent it out. So maybe if you're into IT or something, sitting in your croft, you're making money building websites. You're not really that interested in growing carrots, whatever, you know. So you can then just rent your place out for however many £100 a year to someone else, and they can use it to grow carrots. But the main thing is you also have this income of, if you can be bothered to keep sheep, you have a massive area of land to put your sheep on, and or even cattle. So that as a model is a brilliant model. And I think, you know, it'd be nice in a way to sort of do a bit of a visit up there to see some of these people. They're quite reclusive, the Scots, yeah? They don't really like to brag about things. They're, shall we say, taciturn bunch, but they've got a fantastic model in the Crofting Act of how land should be managed and organised in order to get rid of this whole idea that you can lose it and some giant corporation comes along, buys it up, or, you know, you're booted out and you have to sleep in a ditch.
And Sammy asked a question: as living beings who have the right to live on this planet, why do we need permission given to build our own homes? There's many, many answers with that.
Well, that's a good one, isn't it? Why don't we build a house? Come on, you know. It's one of those things. It's actually not a complicated, difficult thing to do. Just build it. I actually went when I was, I think it was when I was in Dartmoor years ago, I stopped to take a leak, jumped out the car, walked down the road, round a corner, and there was some sort of little, this was the last house ever built. It must have been some mad providence or something, but it was the last house ever built, apparently in Britain, that had been, because there was a law that if you could build the house and you could get smoke up the chimney before sunset, that you could have it. It was yours. And what a great idea. You know, we could just have a bit of a laugh and do that, you know, get some publicity around it.
Brilliant. Well, we have reached like a good time, so so I think whoever's shouting you's got the timing right. But thank you so much, Tony.